Oborne and Heller on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Hello, it's Peter Oborne from West London.
Hello, it's Richard Heller from South East London.
And we have one of my favourite figures in the entire cricketing universe. The man both Richard and I believe is the greatest cricket commentator in the world today, Fazir Mohammed, and he's speaking to us from Trinidad. Good morning, Fazir.
A very good morning to you, Anwar, at this very early hour of the morning here in the Caribbean. To get such flattery from two esteemed gentlemen like yourself, flattery will get you everywhere this morning.
Well, we'll lay it on with a trowel. Fazir, sadly, you won't be commenting on the West Indies tour of England, will you?
No, I won't, unfortunately, which is obviously very disappointing because of the COVID-19 restrictions. And indeed, in my home territory, Trinidad and Tobago, the borders are still closed. And it's really a very strict policy that has been exercised for good reason. Yep. Thankfully, we've only had 8 fatalities and 123 confirmed cases. And I think the authorities would like to keep it that way.
What are your thoughts about the Black Lives Matter issue and West Indies cricket is becoming very controversial?
Phil Simmons confirmed 2 interviews by Jason Holder that West Indian team would show solidarity with Black Lives Matter in some way. And last week we suggested the England team should join them.
Yeah, well, I don't think the West Indies have a choice. I mean, just for the fact of our own history in the Caribbean, our own history of slavery and indentured labour, and indeed the fact that we were colonies, basically there to grow sugar for the colonial masters in the UK. And all that has come from that. We even have a major argument going on right now in my native Trinidad and Tobago about removing the statue of Christopher Columbus from a prominent place in downtown Port of Spain. I know in Barbados, they're having a raging argument of removing a statue of Lord Nelson from downtown Bridgetown. So all of these things are happening. It's tragic that it's taken the killing of George Floyd and the killing of so many Black Americans at the hands of the police to bring this to the fore. But I think it's absolutely necessary for the West Indies cricketers to make a statement when this test series gets underway on July the 8th. And it's equally necessary for England to follow suit, because the last thing you want is for the impression to be created while we're talking about Black Lives Matter going globally, that whether it's an England team or any other country seeming to suggest, well, it's not that big a deal. You don't want a situation where, as happened not so long ago in that English Premier League game, where someone flies a flag over in an airplane saying, well, white lives matter too, over the test venue in Southampton, because that would really, again, send the wrong message. So I think it's imperative. I think it should be accepted that England must follow suit when the West Indies make their statement.
Very, very important words. Fazir, we've just had news in England, the lifting of a lot of restrictions, pubs are opening and so on, but the government still regards cricket, recreational cricket, let alone first-class cricket, as somehow too dangerous, too likely to spread infection to be played. Are they playing cricket in Trinidad at all at the moment?
Well, actually, it was only on Saturday that our Prime Minister, Dr. Keith Rowley, announced the relaxing of restrictions. We're at what we call Phase 5, and it now involves sport. So you could actually have recreational sport, not with any spectators, of course, but certainly we will see over the next few days, I'm sure, lots of recreational cricket getting underway, because people have really been desperate to get out there and get involved in some sort of activity, and cricket would be one of those, yeah.
Fazir, whatever happens in the series, the West Indies will get a tremendous reception. Sadly, not from any crowd, but just they'll be very welcome by England cricket supporters in general, simply, you know, as the first visitors, you know, during our virus crisis. Sadly, you won't be commentating it yourself, but how do you see the series? And are there any West Indian players we should be looking out for in particular?
I think the West Indies will fancy their chances of really battling England hard. Whether they could win the series, it's going to be interesting, because it's always been a challenge for the West Indies to prevail in England over the last 3 decades. In fact, the last time the West Indies won a test series in England takes us all the way back to 1988. Of course, the West Indies are the holders of the Wisden Trophy after that excellent series victory in the Caribbean last year. And we all recall that famous win at Headingley in 2017. So I think the Caribbean fans are cautiously optimistic. They are hopeful that their West Indies team can be as competitive as they were the last time around in the UK. But then again, England prevailed 2-1. And I think England just have that edge as far as experience, familiarity with conditions. And the West Indies batting lineup, quite frankly, is still very fragile, very vulnerable. So I would put England probably to win the series 2-1. For as far as the West Indies players you want to look out for, of course, there's no Shimron Hetmyer. There's no Darren Bravo. There's no Kimo Paul. They've opted out of the tour because of concerns over COVID-19. But I think you're going to want to have a look at Shea Hope, who's looking to have a really good series. He famously scored those twin hundreds at Headingley in 2017. Craig Brathwaite needs to get runs at the top of the order. But it's the bowling, it's the fast bowling especially, that the West Indies see they have an excellent chance. And I think they've got in their team a number of genuine quick bowlers that should make it very, very interesting if they click and if they're able to fire on all cylinders.
By tradition, West Indian supporters are very vocal in any country where they're watching the team. I just wondered how the West Indies are going to cope without them, or indeed without any crowd at all. How do you think they'll adjust to those conditions?
Well, it's one of the unique situations when it comes to test cricket, in the sense that it's very, very normal for West Indies cricketers to play test matches at home in our various territories of the Caribbean with hardly anyone in attendance. In fact, the decline of West Indies as a test-playing nation over the last two decades or so has resulted in a dwindling of crowds for test matches. And indeed, the world has changed as well in our Caribbean region. There's a lot more interest in other sports, in football especially. People spend a lot of time in front of their televisions, watching cable television sport from the United States and other parts of the world. And quite frankly, the West Indies' continued struggles in test cricket has driven a lot of people away from the game. So actually, the West Indies might consider it an advantage to be playing test cricket in England with no huge crowds in attendance to urge on the home side. So because, as I said before, they'll be very, very familiar, unfortunately, to playing test cricket in front of almost no one.
Have you ever commented in the UAE in tests with Pakistan? Because Pakistan played a lot of matches in those great empty stadiums over there.
Yes, I have. And it's a very surreal feeling, although I have to be honest and say that the paltry attendances in Dubai, Abu Dhabi and Sharjah were actually more than for test matches over the last few years than at the Queen's Park Oval here in Trinidad and Tobago. There's been almost no one turning up for test cricket in Trinidad and Tobago.
Good heavens.
How do you as a commentator, go without the crowd, to give that atmosphere and colour? And then actually this summer, how will they comment at all? Presumably out of some biosecure bubble.
I'm sure they'll find a way to sort that out. But I think at the end of it all, Peter, it comes down to, maybe you might want to call it ego, but it's about the love of the game, and it's a privilege to be describing the game. I remember Jim Maxwell once telling me, the Australian commentator, it was one of those territorial matches when Australia were playing Trinidad and Tobago, and the game was just petering out on the last day, and I was in my early stages of commentary, and I made the comment, well, you know, it's probably going to be a pretty dreary day and all of that. And then off air, he mentioned to me that, remember, it's always a privilege for people to welcome you into their living rooms or in their cars or wherever they may be to listen to cricket. And if you send the message that this is all dreary and boring, you're basically telling them, turn off and go somewhere else. And I certainly took that on board. And really, it's a privilege in whatever circumstance, whether there's no one there or it's an absolutely packed house, to be describing the game to somebody out there, whether there are millions or whether it's just one person with an old radio set somewhere in the world. So I've always tried to bring that enthusiasm and that love of the game, whatever the circumstances.
What you're saying about the popularity of the game of cricket in Trinidad and across the West Indies is quite tragic in a way, actually, because, you know, I remember we were brought up on the idea that the Barbados was Trinidad, these great cricket hubs, you know, which, well, the England teams would go there and the crowds would be, the tests would be packed. What's happened?
A combination of factors, as I mentioned previously, but when you've got a team that's been losing as consistently as they have, and I think it's important for your audience to recognize that the West Indies over the last 22 years up to the end of 2019 have lost on average 5 test matches every year. Every single year since 1997, the West Indies have lost 5 test matches per year. And some of those performances have been really abysmal. Added to that, there have been some constant issues pulling and tugging with the West Indies Cricket Board, as it was known at the time, and the West Indies Players Association, that resulted in senior players opting out of certain assignments, players going on strike, lots of disputes and so on. So when you've got a situation of, it's a toxic combination of poor performances, issues off the field that have created a lot of controversy, and the fact, as I said before, that people now have many more different options to exercise their discretionary income. Many people just prefer to stay at home and watch cable television and watch different sports, even cricket, all day on television, rather than give up 5 days to watch test match cricket. Even attendances for one day internationals have dwindled. We had a situation here in Trinidad and Tobago where India, with Virat Kohli and company, were here in September of last year to play a few one-day internationals, and the ground was less than 1/10 full. And if you understand the racial mix in Trinidad and Tobago with that historic East Indian population, the Asian population going back many, many decades, who would have filled the grounds to watch an Indian team apart from supporting the West Indies team, and to have hardly anyone in the ground, it tells you that there's something very deep and very profound that has happened over many years. It didn't happen yesterday or 10 years ago. This has been a situation for some 25, 30 years where there's been a changing of the guard as far as the interest in the game among the younger generations in the Caribbean.
But you do still keep on producing terrific players, don't you? That's one of the things which hasn't gone away.
And I think that that's really a testament to the fact that cricket is very much the bedrock of our sporting societies, whether you're talking about Guyana on the South American mainland, all the way up to Jamaica in the northwest of the Caribbean chain of islands. Cricket, because of our British colonial experience, has really been part of our foundation. So yes, even if fans don't turn up to support the teams, you generally have that interest. You generally have fans arguing among themselves or quarreling as to who should be picked and why they are picking all these Bajans, or why isn't this Jamaican getting selected and why aren't the Trinis getting picked. So there is always that interest, and that's why you'll see talent continuing to come to the fore. We've continued to produce these talented cricketers. I think the challenge has been from that great era, which came to an end in 1995, when the West Indies lost their first home series for some 15 years and they lost to Mark Taylor's Australians. The challenge has been since that time, not just to produce the quality players, but to produce the sort of environment where they're pushed to excel and produce their best every single time.
And also, we need the Chris Gayles. The day that Chris Gayle walked out of the test match team was an awful day for those who love cricket.
I suppose there's an issue that there are mixed feelings in the Caribbean when it comes to the impact of someone like a Chris Gayle. In fact, many West Indian fans will tell you that the preoccupation with the showmanship and the big hitting is actually part of our problem, that we spend far too much time getting preoccupied with the big sixes and the personality issues and all of the showmanship, and not focusing enough on the nuts and bolts of the game. That sometimes, while you might be preoccupied with the flash and the flair of a Chris Gayle, you need someone with the nuts and bolts type of attitude of a Jimmy Adams, or an even earlier period, a Larry Gomes, who will be your excellent counterpoint to a Gordon Greenidge blazing away at the other end at Lord's in 1984, for example, when he got that double hundred. And Larry was at the other end, 92 not out. Mm. And the West Indies winning famously on the last day, chasing 344. So
I saw that. Yeah, it's a wonderful day. That takes us really on to T20, Vazir. See, I mean, some of our previous guests have suggested that T20 is evolving into a separate game from longer forms of cricket. obviously it's a game in which a lot of West Indians are excelling, but is it going to accentuate this trend in favour of the flamboyant big hitting players and away from the bedrock of a test team?
I think it already has, certainly here in the Caribbean, and it seems a situation where a lot of young players gravitate automatically towards the shortest form of the game. In fact, in many of our territories, you have different versions of the game that are played over 20 overs or even shorter. For example, here in Trinidad and Tobago, tennis ball cricket, which is known as wind ball cricket, is enormously popular. You'd have players like Kyron Pollard and Dwayne Bravo coming off the plane from a tour somewhere and then immediately going to some night game played under lights on a tennis court and so on, and is very popular. In Barbados, they have their own version called tape ball cricket, which is similarly very, very popular. So you've got a situation where for West Indies cricketers who are brought up in this sort of environment, who see the immense popularity of the T20 format, the immense revenues as well of the T20 format, and focus their careers on establishing themselves in the T20 game. That's why the West Indies are the defending champions in the World T20. And you've got players like Evan Lewis, the opening batsman, for example. When he was asked about playing test cricket or first-class cricket, he said his ambition is to really play for the Mumbai Indians.
If there is this dichotomy between T20 and long forms of cricket, are the West Indies, in the vanguard of this? Has the split, as it were, gone further in the West Indies than anywhere else?
No question about it, to my mind, because when you really look at the huge differences between the West Indies as a test-playing entity, arguably the greatest cricketing unit that has ever stepped onto a cricket field, the most ominous, the most dominant. And we're not just talking about the 1980s fast bowling era, you're talking about the 1950s, you're talking about the Gary Sobers era of the 1960s, Wes Hall and company, to now where the West Indies are really mediocre when it comes to test cricket, except for the odd occasion when they might give you a fairly decent performance. But generally, the West Indies have been poor at test level for the better part of two decades. And you contrast that with a T20 record that shows them champions twice in the last three tournaments. And indeed, when you look at the franchise game worldwide, not just the IPL, but every other T20 tournament worldwide, your star players, your big names, are invariably West Indian. And there are more and more waiting in the wings to step up to the plate at that global level in the franchise format. So yeah, the dichotomy certainly is accentuated in the Caribbean probably more than anywhere else in the cricketing world.
Interesting. Of course, you can look at this. I know for traditionalists like us, it's quite sad, but it's also an amazing example of the capacity of the game of cricket to reinvent itself. But what is so heartening from this conversation, cricket hasn't died in the West Indies, it's just emerging in a new kind of form. And we really need to celebrate that, as well as us diehard traditionalists saying, oh, isn't it awful, the three W's, so, they've gone away,
You're absolutely right. And even that phrase, Peter, about, these diehard traditionalists, the issue would always be, what tradition are we talking about? Are we talking about the days when test matches were just over 3 days, as when the West Indies started in 1928? Are we talking about uncovered pitches? Are we talking about different elements that we'd like to return to? The game has always evolved, maybe not in the way that we would like. Maybe there are certain elements of it that we yearn to return to. But the thing is, and I'm sure you all would have recognized this because you all are huge fans of the game and are very knowledgeable about it, certainly far more than I am, that the game itself, the social structure that the game lives off has changed throughout the world. It's not a case where you can have people easily giving up 5 days to watch a test match. The world doesn't work that way anymore. The ease with which people can simply drift off to spend an entire day watching a first-class game or a test game doesn't happen anymore. People are holding down two jobs, and I'm sure with COVID-19, it's going to become even more challenging to make that discretionary time to be able to enjoy the game in a recreational setting over a long period of time. So I could only see T20 growing even more in the coming years.
Fazeer, you've been a cricket commentator, I think, since 1987. What brought you into it?
Actually, I grew up in the game. My dad was a really avid cricketer, a very competitive individual as well. And I grew up following him at club level. In fact, very early on, when he would go off to cricket at weekends on a Saturday and Sunday, I would be the scorer for our local club. So it really got me into the numbers of the game, to understanding the game. And then by the time I would have moved into secondary school, to St. Mary's College, which was the secondary school that I attended, by then I was a complete cricket fanatic. Mm. I would follow everything about the game, read everything about the game. And it was always fascinating to hear about the game taking place in other parts of the world. I think what really hooked me completely on the game was commentary of the West Indies defeating Pakistan by one wicket at the 1975 World Cup, when famously Derek Murray and Andy Roberts took the West Indies to victory. Yeah.
Yes. Yep.
Indeed, very painful for Pakistan.
Still causes controversy in Pakistan. Handling the bowlers and so on. Yeah. Mm.
But from that point onwards, I was hooked, and it was just almost a simple graduation, because as with anyone young person fascinated with the game, I always harbored ambitions of actually playing for Trinidad and Tobago and the West Indies as a left-arm spinner. I was never good enough. I really lacked the quality in that regard. But I then recognized that, look, you know, I know a lot about the game. I seem to know quite a bit about the game. And I really felt that the best way outside of actually playing it at the highest level was to get a foot in the door doing cricket coverage. Actually, I joined a newspaper, the Trinidad Guardian, in 1987 as a junior reporter, a freelance reporter. And was basically doing occasional reports on cricket. And I only got my first opportunity to do commentary in 1992 for what was then the tournament known as the Shell Shield between Trinidad and Tobago and Barbados, where I actually filled in on the last day of a four-day match for one of the senior commentators who had to return to his native island. So that gave me the opportunity. And from that point onwards, I started to develop my skills and my confidence doing radio commentary, which remains my first love. And from that point on, things developed, because with more and more cricket being played and being given more opportunities, I was able to refine and hone my skills and develop those opportunities from that point on.
It's so interesting. Who were your great formative influences? When you started to study commentary, learn how to do it, what were the people who really influenced you?
I suppose when you think about it, I never really studied in the sense of the techniques and the nuances of commentary, other than just simply enjoying hearing certain voices. Certainly Tony Kozier, sadly, who passed away just about four years ago. To me, he is the Gary Sobers of cricket reporting, because he would have done everything, writing, broadcasting, radio and television, for a long period, a voracious appetite for the game, encyclopedic knowledge of the game. And I think because you would be listening to so much West Indies cricket, you would always be hearing Tony Kozier. So Tony's style definitely influenced me in my own style of commentary. But also, I mentioned that 1975 experience with West Indies Pakistan at the World Cup. You've got the famous voices, of course, John Arlott, Don Mosey, and so many others from that era. But also, I remember famously the 1975-76 series in Australia, where I was able to listen to it on the radio, of course. We didn't have live television in those days. And I was preparing for what we would call my 11-plus examinations. I was just 10 years going on 11. And I would spend all through the night listening to commentary. And Alan McGilvery certainly impressed me as a commentator. And I think more than anything else, what struck me was the ability to paint a picture for the listener, to be the eyes of the listener. And I remember at midnight, some Christmas period, 1975, and listening to Alan McGilvery welcoming the audience to a gloriously sunny day at the MCG when it was midnight back in the Caribbean. And just that imagery struck me as to the power of a commentator to create that image for his listener.
Alan McGilvray commented in the interwar period, a long career, commented in the interwar period from cables. Remember, he made out, you know, the outline of play would be communicated by cable, and he'd make up, you know, the actual play and all the colour, and that was a glorious stroke by Hammond or Bradman. He'd do it straight
and all the different noises.
And he'd make the noise with the pencil on the microphone.
And indeed, we in the Caribbean, because of our limited resources, we haven't been able over the many years to send commentary teams to different parts of the Caribbean every time. So sometimes we'd actually be doing commentary off the television screen and creating this, trying to create the same sort of atmosphere. And many people have asked, you know, how can it possibly be interesting to be commentating, watching a television screen? And my response has been, when you get locked in and you get caught up in it, it becomes like anything else. It comes almost like being actually there because you're so preoccupied with describing the action and bringing that enthusiasm to the listener wherever he or she may be.
You spoke very movingly about how you were influenced by Tony Kozier. Tell us a little bit about how you first met him and how he kind of, your personal relationship with him.
Meeting Tony Kozier was like, for want of a better term, meeting a cricketing god. It was 1988. I had just started working for a newspaper in Trinidad and Tobago. And I went to the press box for the test match, 1988, West Indies against Pakistan. Tremendous test series, tremendous test match. But I was just in awe of seeing Tony Kozier sitting there, and I couldn't approach him. I had to ask one of my senior journalists from my newspaper to introduce me to Tony Kozier. And indeed, he was very gracious and very pleasant and so on. But you could see that he had more important things to do than to talk to this cub reporter who probably was of no consequence and whatever. But subsequently, when I actually was starting to doing work writing on the game in that same series, Tony actually contacted my senior reporting colleague to say that he was quite impressed with my writing. I was in seventh heaven from that point onwards. And from that point on, whenever I would have encountered him, because he would have been traveling the world, I would have been only doing matches in my native Trinidad and Tobago, he would always ask of me and how my career was going and what I can do to develop my skills and so on. And he was so very helpful. And I think over the years, as I graduated into the commentary box in radio and television, and we would sit side by side in the press box, I wouldn't say that we were exactly kindred spirits, because he was a far more sociable personality than I was. I live very much a hermetic type of lifestyle. I'm almost antisocial in that regard. But Tony was very, very different. But when it came to cricket, we seemed to share so much about the game, the love for the game, the love for the history of the game, and the great respect for West Indies cricket. I think what hurt Tony the most over the last few decades was to see not just a West Indies decline, but to hear all of the disparaging remarks about West Indies cricket, as if to suggest that we never had that great history. And I enjoyed all my years working alongside him, not just for the professional skills, but for the mere fact that he just simply loved the game and had such an immense work rate. He did so much work, radio, television, reporting for numerous newspapers all over the world. He never seemed to not be working. And I certainly didn't and have never had that level of attention to the amount of work that would be done in the game. I'm very lazy compared to a Tony Kozier. I just had immense admiration for him and his level of professionalism. He never tolerated shoddy work. He always believed that you had to be prepared whenever you went on air. And there are so many lessons that I picked up from Tony Kozier.
I love your expression that Kozier was the Gary Sobers. He had such a beautiful voice. He had, as you do, you also remind me of John Arlott, because there's something very poetic about your commentary. You have the enthusiasm, but you also have the ability to create phrases and images, which is very vivid. And John Arlott, of course, was a poet as well as a cricket commentator, and that he brought some sort of richness of vocabulary, which I think is missing in many commentators today.
You know, Peter, I remember many years ago, I was doing a one-day international, I believe it was, in St. Vincent, tiny island, one of those islands relatively new to international cricket way back in the 1980s. At that time, they've had their first one-day international, but it was probably about 15 years ago, I was just arriving at the airport in St. Vincent at Arnas Vale, and the taxi driver mentioned to me that his mother, who was blind, loves listening to me because I am able to paint a picture for her. And that, and to me, that was the most humbling sort of regard for whatever I do, whether it's any good or not. The fact that you'd have people tuning in and listening and appreciating whatever imagery you're trying to create. I know sometimes I drift into a lot of nonsense that maybe some people don't like, but the, I think what I appreciated from what he was saying was that I was able to be her eyes and really to provide that sort of imagery, which really I think is what the job is all about.
It's very interesting what you say there about the blind person. Jamshid Marka, who was the first Pakistani cricket commentator after independence in 1947. Richard and I went to visit him, lovely man, Parsi in Karachi. And he said that for him, commentary was, he was always imagining a blind person describing, sitting next to a friend of his who was blind and describing the game to them. And that was a very moving image.
I'm sure it would be. I could actually hear a lot of players or former players saying, well, they're accustomed playing cricket with blind people. They're called umpires.
Wilfred Rhodes, at the end of his long life, he was blind, but used to go to watch cricket matches and simply listen. And he could tell the play from the sounds. He could tell whether a batsman was batting well or not, just by the sound of the ball on the bat.
Indeed, and in fact, there's a young man in Trinidad and Tobago who's traveled the world. He's done tours of New Zealand and the UK, and he's completely blind. But he does radio reports back to his radio station in Trinidad and Tobago. And you list it, it's exactly as you describe it, Richard. There's the sound of the ball on bat. You can tell whether it's an inside edge or whether it's miscued or whether it's gone past the outside edge. Just the sounds, the natural sounds of the game, especially for the blind with all of the focus on the auditory senses, they can certainly tell exactly what is going on just by listening to it.
When Richard and I were writing our book on cricket in Pakistan, I was travelling through the northern areas, through the Hindu Kush, and there was a shepherd far up, thousands and thousands of feet up in the Hindu Kush. He was blind and he had a radio and he knew every fact and figure in world cricket. And he knew it simply by listening to cricket commentary. It was very beautiful.
I think that's the attraction of radio commentary still. We used to have for many, many years when the radio and television commentary were perfectly synchronized, where people would turn down the television commentary and listen to the radio because you'd get a lot more detail, quite obviously, because you have to describe everything ball by ball and all that is going on. Whereas television, you talk around the pictures because the pictures tell the story. In radio, you get so much more information, so much more context, so much more history. There's so much more opportunity to delve into various issues about the game. It becomes almost a history lesson sometimes.
And that is why I do believe there's a special art to being the frontman commentator, holding it all together. Do you agree with me? It annoys me now listening to Test Match Special, for instance. In the old days, Arlott would hold it for the six balls, or Johnson, and then the commentator, Trevor Bailey, would come in between overs with his summary analysis. And what you get now is Michael Vaughan is allowed to crash in and encouraged to crash in, whoever the summariser is, on the commentator and play a much more dominant role. And I think that diminishes the ability of the main guy to do to create these word pictures we're talking about.
Yeah, and I think that's how I learned the art of commentary very early on, working alongside the likes of a Tony Kozier or a Joseph Reds Pereira, who would have travelled the world as well, doing commentary on behalf of the West Indies, that you allowed the ball-by-ball commentator to describe the entire over. if something unusual were to happen, he would pause and I would allow the summariser to come in with his expert comments. But it's only towards the end of the over that whoever that summariser is, whether it's a former player of some great repute or something, or someone who knows a lot about the game, to come in and offer analysis. But I think what we are moving towards now, and it's no slight on Michael Vaughan specifically or anyone else of those former players, is that it's now so much driven by the former player environment, where the professional broadcasters are being pushed more and more into the background. And that's why you have the situation now where before you've barely completed the sentence of him pushing into the offside and getting a single, the score moves on to 125 for two. You already have the expert former player coming in with something every single ball. And yes, it does take away from your opportunity to develop certain points and develop certain narratives that you want to have in the course of your commentary.
It's a pity, because I certainly think, and others have heard it suggested frequently, that the sequencing in cricket is absolutely ideal for radio commentary in a way that other sports aren't. Unlike, say, soccer or horse racing, the commentator always has to rush to keep up with events, or tennis. There's a sequence in cricket, the ball's delivered, the batter responds, the fielder reacts, and it allows time for the radio commentator to do exactly what you've described, Fazia, to give the score, say what's happened, give the score, and add those little details. It's a great shame
Absolutely.
To lose it.
It is, and I think that's why I've enjoyed cricket commentary so much, because it develops your skills as a broadcaster. It expands your knowledge on the game, because you get involved in all sorts of discussions, some of it directly related to what is going on. You can get involved in a tangential conversation about different things, about Ireland politics, about different issues about the game and so on, all without losing that focus on the game. And that develops your own skills, your own depth of your knowledge, your breadth of experiences, your breadth of expressions, and really being able to grow in the game. I've actually done football commentary as well. In fact, before I did cricket commentary to any serious international level, I was doing football commentary of our local schools' football competitions season after season. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, because I enjoyed the different skill that was required in being able to keep up with a fast-paced game non-stop, and especially to be able to pronounce all of the unusual names without missing a beat. And to me, that was a different type of skill, a very different skill from doing cricket commentary.
What was your biggest mistake?
Must have been a few. Yeah, every now and again. Yeah.
Well, now you're really taxing my memory, because there are so many of them. I've had so many gaffes along the way that from very early on, I recall I was so nervous. I was absolutely nervous the first time I was doing an international match in 1992, West Indies versus South Africa at the Queen's Park Oval. It was the first time that an official South African team had come to the Caribbean, and they were playing that one-day international. And I was sweating profusely, because I was working alongside the great Sir Gary Sobers. There was Michael Holding as well. And I think I said something along the lines of, welcome to the Queen's Park Oval, and coming in now from the pavilion end. And I was actually at the other end of the ground. I was at the northern end of the ground. And Michael Holding was pointing backwards to me as if to indicate that, look, you're commentating from the northern end, because obviously he's on air. He doesn't want to contradict me on air. But the way he was signaling, it seemed to suggest to me that he was telling me to get out of the commentary chair because I was so poor. And I got even more nervous, not realizing that basically what he was trying to do was correct me as to the end of that I was describing the action coming from. So that sticks in my mind almost immediately. When we talk about the many mistakes I would have made during commentary, that certainly stands out. I was an absolute nervous wreck. I had no idea what I was doing, because I was totally nervous. Even though I knew about the game, I was just so in awe of being in the company of so many outstanding cricketers.
What are the great moments you can look back on?
I think one that stands out immediately was 1999, West Indies against Australia in Barbados, where the West Indies at that time had just come from South Africa, had been shellacked 5-0 in the Test Series, had lost the one day as 6-1, I believe it was. And Brian Lara, the captain, was virtually put on probation because there was so much that went wrong in that tour of South Africa, the first ever official tour to South Africa by a West Indies team. And he responded in the most incredible fashion with a double hundred, a match-winning double hundred in the second test in Jamaica. And then when it came to Barbados for the third test, the series was at that point 1-1. The West Indies on the last day needing to get 309 for victory. Lara scored 153 not out. And I was involved in the last passage of commentary. And because I was so into it, so caught up in the drama and describing everything that was going on, the female commentator, Donna Simmons, who has done some work for the BBC as well, of course, in the year 2000 in the UK, she said, look, you know, you go ahead. You're into the zone. You're all into it. You're all sweating profusely and whatever, and you're all caught up in it. You just keep on going. So I basically did my last stint of commentary, which would usually be about 20 minutes. I probably did an hour commentating the drama of that last bit of action when Lara took the West Indies to that famous victory. That stands out in my mind as my most memorable bit of radio commentary.
I'd love to have listened to that. And what an unusual piece of generosity.
And I think people like Donna Simmons are individuals you have to remember along the way, because everywhere in anyone's career, whatever profession you're in, there's always someone who does something that allows you to really express yourself or to get opportunities in whatever it is you do. And I especially mentioned Donna because she developed her skills as a commentator in a very chauvinistic Caribbean environment. People would always sort of make remarks behind her back about why is this woman involved in commentary? This is a man's game and all of that sort of thing. And we're talking about way back in 1987 when I first heard her doing radio commentary in Barbados when Trinidad and Tobago were playing Barbados. It was the first time I was actually covering a game for my Trinidad Guardian newspaper. And she had to endure a lot of those comments over the years. She's now a very successful lawyer. She's very well respected in her native Barbados. But there were always these snide comments, unfortunately, during that time, which suggested that she wasn't deserving of an opportunity as a commentator. And I thought it enormously generous of her to miss out on that opportunity to describe such thrilling action in 1999, and to give me that opportunity to continue.
Very, says a lot for him. One of our guests a couple of weeks ago was Peter Gibbs, who was a county cricket player and then became a very successful screenwriter, and he sent us very entertaining radio play he wrote about an imaginary episode in Test Match Special in which a physical brawl breaks out, there's swearing and bad language, and questions are asked in the Houses of Parliament, and it's a very entertaining radio play. Be very glad to send it to you, but without mentioning any names, has anything as melodramatic as that ever happened to you in the commentary box, or have you witnessed it?
Thankfully, nothing as dramatic as that, as to a brawl breaking out, although there have been occasions when there have been confrontations at the back of the commentary box. I remember a famous occasion. I can call the names as well because it's well known. In 1990, West Indies versus England, in that very, very intense series, and the first that was ever televised continuously from the Caribbean, where Michael Holding, who was now a television commentator as a former player, had some really strong words with Geoffrey Boycott. I don't know anyone in the game who hasn't had strong words with or against Geoffrey Boycott in that regard. And they, because as former players, so close to the game, they were really caught up in the intensity of the action, and there was some strong language at the back of the commentary box way back then. But thankfully, nothing developing into anything resembling a brawl.
Actually, on which matter, since Sir Geoffrey has just announced that he's stepping down as a summariser for TMS, perhaps you could give your own analysis of his contribution in the commentary box.
I think Geoffrey Boycott is Geoffrey Boycott. You know what you're going to get. The very direct, very gruff, sometimes very harsh sort of analysis. But it is what it is. And I think there are different elements to every personality. I think the last thing you'd want is a sort of monochromatic type of commentary where you've got people saying all the right things. Sometimes it may not be politically correct. Sometimes it might be awkward and so on. But this is what live cricket commentary is all about. You may have certain situations, certain perceptions, and certain attitudes which are out of touch with the societies in which we live in now. But I think what you got from Geoffrey Boycott was knowledge, passion, yes, maybe a dismissive attitude to anything that he didn't like or disagreed with, but there was always the counterpoint of his commentating colleague, because I recall, for example, an occasion where he was rather dismissive and almost laughing at the personalities who were involved in a three-man committee who were analysing West Indies cricket in 2007. And Tony Kozier was doing the ball-by-ball commentary during that series in England in 2007. And Tony more or less had to, for want of a better term, put him in his place and say, well, not everyone has to be a test player or a former test player to know about the game. There are some people who absolutely love the game, who are very well educated, who understand organizational requirements and structures and so on. So it was good that you had someone like a Tony Kozier, for example, and not necessarily just to confront someone like a Geoffrey Boycott, but to provide a counterpoint.
And how did Geoffrey deal with Tony Kozier's wise words?
He didn't take it well, let's put it that way, which isn't surprising.
I tell you, I'd love to have met Geoff Boycott's granny. She must have been an absolute hell of a player.
Absolutely, because the amount of time she was referred to, I was checking the records, I think it was on Crick Info, but I put Boycott's granny, nothing came up.
Clearly better than so many players he described.
But also, I mean, imagine if she was able to use a proper cricket bat rather than a stick of rhubarb. I mean, her achievements would have been enormous.
Absolutely.
She'd have been unplayable. You mentioned Gary Sobers. Do you have any special memories of him, either as a player or in the commentary box?
Actually, I never had the privilege of seeing Sir Gary live in action because I was way too young by the time his test career came to an end. I was just 9 years old when he played his last test match in 1974. Actually, his last test match was at Port of Spain at Queen's Park Oval here in Trinidad and Tobago. But of course, when you watch all the footage, when you hear everyone talk about him, when he's actually in his company, you certainly get a sense of his aura and his impact on the game and his the huge admiration for him all over the world. But you also get that sense of the personality. As smiling and as easygoing as he was also very sensitive to anything perceived as unfair criticism. And I can give you an example from just last year when he was being celebrated in his native Barbados on a local radio talk show, and people were calling in and giving great congratulations and celebrating his great achievements. And I was asked as a journalist broadcaster to offer my own recollections. And I referenced how disappointing it was for him to not be able to take West Indies to victory in his last test match in 1974. And immediately his tone changed because he heard it as a criticism in the sense, and not just a criticism of that 1974 incident, but he immediately turned it backwards to 1968, also at Queen's Park Oval, when he declared twice the West Indies lost and lost the series. And he was never forgiven for that. And to me, that encapsulated that for all of the great achievements of Sir Garfield Sobers, he still remained very vulnerable or insecure to what he perceived to be an unfair criticism. I was talking about 1974. All he heard was 1968 and the Twin Declarations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sobers, as we've said, was a player who had a great aura about him, as did a lot of the West Indians we saw in that whole era. Frank Worrell had a different kind of aura. Wes Hall had a different kind of aura. And later on, Clive Lloyd, Viv Richards, and then we've just spoken about Brian Lara. where's all the aura gone, Fuzzier? Can we expect it to be restored at some point?
I think when we talk about aura, it's interesting because when you put it in a Caribbean context, we're talking about individuals who are sometimes larger than life from their own territories. And it brings, even when you talk about the aura of a Viv Richards, the imagery of a Viv Richards walking to the crease, whether it's at Lord's Packed House for a World Cup final, or even at a venue where there's absolutely no one there and Richards is walking to the crease, his mere presence told a story. Yet you have that imagery of someone formidable, someone imposing, yet still very, very vulnerable as an individual, because many of our outstanding West Indian cricketers and indeed West Indian personalities are very, very insecure as to the criticism that they might have to endure, as to how they are perceived in their respective territories as against other territories. Because we need to remember that when we talk about the West Indies, you're talking about 14, 15 sovereign nations who play sport individually outside of cricket. And therefore, there will always be those rivalries. So yes, you'd have a Brian Lara, you'd have a Kirtley Ambrose, you'd have so many other big names in the game, even a Chris Gayle in the relatively modern era, who give off that image of being utterly confident and utterly assured about themselves. Yet when they're in an environment where they're asked tough questions, or where they're being criticized, or whether they are going through a bad patch and facing questions about their careers, they suddenly turn very, very very much inward and become very vulnerable. And then you see a personality which tells you that many of our sporting personalities and indeed former cricketers of over many eras aren't as assured of themselves as we might think. And maybe that overreaction on the field, the aggression and the what we might perceive to be hostility, is almost a counterpoint to that vulnerability off the field in different environments.
That's interesting. If you were given supreme power over West Indian cricket, and why on earth not, what would you do about it?
Well, if I were permitted to be the ultimate tyrant, which I think is what we probably need in West Indies cricket, you need to have that strength of leadership. And it really has to be a situation where you disband all of the territorial politics, because that is what is killing West Indies cricket, where people are more preoccupied with their territorial priorities, people from my territory getting picked, people from my territory getting opportunities. And we need to get back to that focus on the overall development of West Indies cricket. We need to ensure that cricket is back in the schools at a strong level, properly funded, and we need to bring integrity back to the game so that you're comfortable, whether they're cricket people or even players, people with no cricketing pedigree, that they are focused primarily on the health and the welfare of territorial and West Indies cricket. It will take some time, it won't happen overnight, but will gradually produce that successful environment where once again we'll be consistently successful, because we've always had talent, that is not an issue, but it's the integrity and the leadership and doing the right things at the right time which continue to be devilish.
Are you still bowling any left arm spin, Fazia?
Thankfully not.
No, that's a shame. If you're ever in England and you want a weekend game, Peter and I both run teams and we always need a left arm spinner. Yeah. And finally, you delighted listeners 3 years ago with performing the Calypso for Sunil Gavaskar. Any others in prospect? And could we tempt you to rehearse one now?
Well, I was thinking about it and I was saying, well, what about the one about Vivian Richards in that year, 1976? The Calypsonian, a very famous Calypsonian from his home territory, Antigua, the twin island state of Antigua Barbuda, by the name of Lord Shortshoot, wrote a calypso in praise of him. That was even before he had gone on that tour of 1976, where he scored the 829 runs and so on. And it talked about Vivian Richards. And it goes something like this. I'll do the chorus. Apologies to all your audience if they're suddenly assailed by the crackling voice. But it goes something like this. No bowler holds a terror for Vivian Richards, not Thompson and Lily, not Bedi, not Chandrasekhar. Perfect coordination of body and mind. That brother is really dynamite. Pace or spin, he don't give a France where you're bowling him. Fast or slowly, you're going back to the boundary. That's a bit of it.
That's wonderful.
Oh, it's lovely. That's wonderful, and what a great man to celebrate.
Indeed. When's the album coming out, Fazia?
Well, I've tried my best to have a recording career, but I've been brushed aside every time.
Fazia, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute thrill and a pleasure talking to you. We can get a sense of why you've been such a great commentator, given so much pleasure to listeners worldwide over so many years. Thank you again for joining us at such an unearthly hour.
Fazia, it was such a pleasure talking to you. A real joy. Thank you.
An absolute privilege. Thank you very much, gentlemen.